Thank you for joining us this afternoon. My name is Logan Brokart, Senior Health Promotion Specialist, and I'll be moderating today's webinar, Ontario's New Tobacco Control Measures, Implementation, Triumphs, and Trials. If you're having trouble logging on to the webinar, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This help number is 1-800-363-7822. For those of you who logged into our webinar, you will see the presentation on your right. On the left-hand side of the screen, you will see a chat box. We've set aside time for questions after the presentation, but anytime during the presentation, feel free to enter any question into this box, and we'll address it as we can. We may not answer the questions in order, but we will do our best to answer each question at the appropriate time. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to get a better sense of how many have joined us today. Please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number. Thanks so much, everyone. Now I'd like to introduce you to our presenters. Jolene DeBray is a research officer at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, where she coordinates evaluation research related to the implementation and enforcement of smoke-free policies, supports OTRU's knowledge evaluation services requests, and contributes to the writing of OTRU's strategy monitoring report. Tracy Borland has been a research officer with OTRU since 2009. With an MSc in International Public Health Policy from the University of Edinburgh, her interests include health equity and commercial tobacco use, global health governance, community-based research, and qualitative methods. Tracy's work with OTRU is focused on youth smoking prevention and commercial tobacco reduction for pregnant and recently pregnant women, construction and manufacturing employees, and First Nations, Inuit, and Métis communities. Michael Chaitin is a scientist at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. His work involves understanding the impact of policy on smoking cessation and the development of tobacco-related comorbidities, and he is the co-instructor of the graduate-level course, Tobacco and Health, From Cells to Society.
Thank you very much, Logan. So today we'll be talking about one of OTRU's, the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit's, ongoing projects, evaluating the implementation of Ontario's new tobacco control measures. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge Rob Schwartz, who couldn't be with us here today, but is an integral part of this project as well. These new measures are, some aren't so new anymore. They are the regulations, measures, and legislation that were developed around the time of the Healthy Choices Act and the E-Cigarette Act. These measures that we're interested in include the January 2015 smoking ban on playgrounds, sporting areas, restaurants, and bar patios, the January 2016 ban on e-cigarette sales to youth, the ban on flavored tobacco, or the regulations, I would say, rather than ban, the smoking ban on hospital grounds with designated smoking areas, the increased fines for tobacco sales to youth, the ban on selling tobacco on post-secondary campuses. Just more recently, in January 2016, this now includes the ban on menthol tobacco that was implemented, and we are still waiting for the implementation of the January 2018 100% ban on hospital grounds. The aim of this evaluation is to assess the implementation and the impact of these new tobacco and e-cigarette policy measures that, as they come into force or currently come into force. There, we assess the awareness and support for these measures, as well as compliance and enforcement, looking at the success of these measures, the challenges associated with their implementation and effectiveness, as well as some of the unintended consequences of these measures on tobacco control and other areas. This is a broad evaluation, and we use many different methods to be able to triangulate our evaluation of these measures. Today we'll be using a few, we'll be showing the results from a few of these methods, including youth exploratory interviews, analysis of the tobacco inspection system data for that's collected by the tobacco enforcement officers, street intercepts and online surveys that have been conducted by TCANs, five different TCANs over two different years, a tobacco enforcement officer and manager survey that was sent directly and filled out by the officers and managers at 33 of 36 public health units, 16 key informant interviews, and as well as population survey data that we'll be showing at the beginning. So there's a lot of data that we'll be presenting today, and I think really a lot of rich finding that has come out of the work that we've been doing over the past year or two in some cases. Today I'll start off talking about some of the public support for new measures before handing off to Jolene and Tracy to talk about some of the survey and interview results. These data come from the 2016 CAMH Monitor. The CAMH Monitor is a population representative survey of Ontario adults that is conducted every year and has been for about 30 years. And we include different questions asking about support for a variety of tobacco control measures, some of which are in place and some of which are not yet. And we'll be highlighting the responses of these to the ones more relevant to these new measures. We find that support for smoke-free places is very high, I mean, particularly among non-smokers, with support for regulation of bans on smoking in these places, ranging from 96% for banning smoking near outdoor children's playgrounds, down to 72%, which is still very high, restricting smoking in public parks and beaches. Unsurprisingly, current smokers have a mixed level of support of these bans, although support is generally very high, with close to 86% of outdoor children's playgrounds smokers support these bans. The one with the greatest disconnect between current smokers and non-smokers is their support for outdoor patios, where smokers only have 36% support for bans on smoking in these places. That is a good question about the Ontario Open. If I just see the question right now, and Christine Valle-Eal has asked about if there's any data that's presented today as part of Ontario's Open Government Open Data Initiative, can they be easily accessed, downloaded, and manipulated? That is a very good question. I don't know the full answer. Many of the statistics here are available as on our TIMS website, so TIMS.otru.org, and all of those data are available, and you can see them trends over the past number of years and look at them by age and sex and other characteristics. Some of the interview data, of course, is more sensitive, but the statistical data is available on our TIMS. We also looked at support for flavor restrictions, and we find moderate levels of support among both non-smokers at 65% and current smokers at 39%. Interestingly, the support for flavor bans on e-cigarette products is relatively similar to those on cigarette products, marginally lower, but not significant in this sample. At 61% for non-smokers and 35% for current smokers. Most people, both smokers and non, support the banning of a sale of e-cigarettes to youth under 19 years of age. And majorities of both smokers and non-smokers support the ban on use of e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, in settings currently covered by smoke-free legislation. So these, all these support numbers we also looked at in, these are 2016 numbers, and we looked at them previously in 2015 as well. And we saw very little change between the 2 years. Most of the change, marginal effects among smokers who actually improved their support for many of these laws. And right now I'll turn it over to Jillian and Susan.
Thanks, Michael. So next, part of the next part of the presentation, we'll first start presenting the evaluation findings related to the outdoor smoking bans on playgrounds, sporting areas, restaurant and bar patios, and hospital grounds. Among Street Intercept survey respondents, awareness for the smoking ban on restaurant and bar patios increased from 67% in 2015 to 74% in 2016. Similarly, awareness for the smoking ban on playground and sporting areas increased from 54% in 2015 to 63% in 2016. Self-reported smoking behavior at regulated outdoor spaces continues to be quite high. The highest frequency of self-reported smoking in 2016 occurred at park festivals and fairs at 71%, followed by restaurant and bar patios at 48%, sport fields at 44%, and playgrounds at 28%. There was no change in self-reported smoking behavior between 2015 and 16. However, smokers reported smoking less frequently at all affected venues in 2015 compared to the year before the survey. Substantial levels of self-reported exposure to secondhand smoke continued to be reported in 2016, ranging from 44% at playgrounds to 80% at park festivals or fairs. Significant decreases in self-reported secondhand smoke exposure were reported in 2015 compared to the year before the survey for all outdoor regulated spaces. In contrast, increases in self-reported exposure to secondhand smoke were noted between 2015 and 16 for sports fields, playgrounds, and on restaurant bar patios. Possible explanations for the increase in secondhand smoke exposure include the use of a convenience sample that is not representative of the individual health unit or province, different health units that were involved in the two different years of the survey, or just the increased sensitivity to secondhand smoke exposure in an era of smoke-free policies. Nearly half of survey respondents exposed to secondhand smoke at sports fields reported that the drifting smoke was coming from the regulated sports field or spectator area. One-third or fewer respondents exposed to secondhand smoke at playgrounds and on restaurant bar patios reported that the drifting smoke was coming from the outdoor regulated space. So still quite a bit happening there. Compliance was quite high in the first year of implementation of the outdoor smoking regulations on restaurant bar patios, playgrounds, and sporting areas, ranging from 86 to 96%. However, compliance with smoking on the outdoor spaces fell in 2016 for all three areas. Individual hospital compliance with the smoking ban on hospital grounds was only 40% in the first year of implementation. I should note that caution should be taken when interpreting these results because inspections are conducted mainly in response to complaints. Therefore, not all outdoor public spaces affected by the smoking regulations were inspected each year. A number of factors contributed to the success of the outdoor smoking regulations implementation. These included improved compliance over time, increased awareness among owner-operators of the affected outdoor spaces, increased public awareness. Having a pre-existing bylaw already in place was helpful since relationships with the municipality were already established, as well as protocols around signage. Public awareness and compliance was also generally higher in these municipalities with a pre-existing bylaw. Collaborating with local public health inspectors to disseminate education and or signage to restaurants and bar owners during the food inspections was a success. And addressing complaints in a timely manner and resolving concerns at the specific locations also contributed to a successful implementation. A number of general cross-cutting challenges to the implementation of all the outdoor smoking regulations were reported. These included similar to the CEO and manager survey that was conducted in the previous year in 2015, resistance to post no smoking signage was one of the main challenges to implementation in all the regulated outdoor spaces. Lack of awareness, not having adequate staffing to proactively enforce the outdoor smoking regulations in all the affected outdoor spaces, having an overlapping bylaw and the Smoke-Free Ontario Act outdoor regulations, funding to post signage, and legislative gaps, such as the exclusion of daycare playgrounds as a regulated outdoor public space, or the lack of proper definition of a boundary of a playground or sporting area, making it difficult to enforce where the 20-meter setback begins and ends, or a lack of a setback around restaurant bar patios to prevent smokers from standing right next to the patio to smoke. There were also challenges to implementation reported for specific outdoor regulated spaces. For hospitals, a lack of standardized government-issued signs posted at entrances or the designated smoking area was problematic. Enforcement was mainly conducted by hospital security staff, which may be limited throughout the day or not taken seriously by the public because of their inability to enforce with penalty. Enforcement staff reported difficulties enforcing smoking among mental health patients, seniors, and non-ambulatory patients, noting there was also a compassionate challenge to charge a visitor who may be visiting a sick or dying relative. Larger sized hospital grounds proved more difficult to obtain compliance because individuals had to travel further to smoke, making it particularly difficult for individuals with limited mobility. Finally, some TEOs and managers reported encountering challenges when dealing with hospitals' placement and structure of the outdoor designated smoking area. For playgrounds and sports fields, as noted in the previous slide, there continued to be resistance to post signage by some municipalities. However, some municipalities that did post signage in the affected outdoor areas were posting signage in low numbers in inappropriate locations or in areas not clearly visible to the public. Some enforcement staff also reported a lack of internal support from their own health unit to stand up to the municipality to encourage the municipality to post the required sign. For patios, the broad definition of a restaurant bar patio in the outdoor smoking regulation resulted in various outdoor spaces becoming smoke-free that were not traditionally considered a restaurant and bar patio. For example, a factory cafeteria, golf course, food truck events, park fairs, and festivals. Interpretation of this patio definition also varied across the province, such as some municipalities making their park, festival, and fairs completely smoke-free, while other municipalities did not. Last, compared to other outdoor regulated public spaces, an increased likelihood of dealing with confrontation, such as a mob mentality among restaurant and bar patrons, was reported. We also explored unintended consequences, both positive and negative. For hospital grounds, a positive unintended consequence was that a couple of hospitals decided to go 100% smoke-free almost immediately in 2016, while two additional hospitals were looking into going smoke-free ahead of the 2018 deadline. In contrast, the smoking ban on hospital grounds had pushed smokers onto the sidewalks and adjacent private properties surrounding the hospital, leading to numerous complaints about cigarette butt litter and secondhand smoke exposure in these areas. That would be a negative. For one hospital in particular, all the smokers would be pushed to the only access point of the property when the designated smoking area would be removed in 2018. This would result in everyone being exposed to secondhand smoke when entering the hospital grounds. For playgrounds and sports fields, in municipalities with a pre-existing bylaw, there was interplay between the bylaw and the provincial outdoor smoking regulations, resulting in confusion about what areas were smoke-free and what distance smokers needed to be from the regulated area. Some municipalities amended an existing bylaw to make the entire park or municipal beaches smoke-free to eliminate the gray areas and confusion about where individuals could smoke. One municipality's pre-existing bylaw restricted smoking within 9 meters from playgrounds and sporting areas. The bylaw signage was not replaced when the provincial outdoor smoking regulations were implemented, making it difficult for enforcement officers to charge someone who was smoking within the 9 to 20 meters from a playground or sporting area. And for restaurant and bar patios, without any defined setback from the patio area, smokers were lighting up immediately beside the patio, causing smoke to drift onto the smoke-free patio area. Smokers were also congregating on the sidewalk and the entrance to the restaurant bar, forcing non-smokers to walk through clouds of smoke when entering or exiting the premise and deterring new customers from entering. As mentioned in the previous slide, the broad definition of restaurant bar patios in the outdoor smoking regulations resulted in various outdoor spaces becoming smoke-free that were not traditionally considered a restaurant bar patio. So next, we'll present the evaluation results related to the flavored tobacco sales regulations. In 2016, 95% of tobacco vendors and tobacco vendors that were inspected did not have flavored tobacco on their store shelves. A number of factors contributed to the success of the flavored tobacco sales ban implementation. These included increased awareness among tobacco vendors, improved compliance among tobacco vendors over time, increased public awareness about flavored tobacco bans, and distributors calling the Health Unit for clarification on products offered to retailers. Here's a list of challenges that were encountered while implementing the flavored tobacco sales ban. Relabeling of flavored tobacco to meet exemptions, such as stickers placed on packages to mark the package as wine instead of grape. New tobacco products that attempt to fall under exemptions, such as ice wine flavored cigars. New tobacco products that appear to be flavored, though not marked as flavored, such as blue or silver. Lack of awareness among tobacco vendors about the products that are impacted by the flavored ban. And tobacco reps visit vendors frequently, often giving out misinformation to vendors about what flavored products can be sold. And finally, a lack of TEO training to identify legal and illegal flavored tobacco products, such as the juicy Blunterillos, shisha, or pan. Next, I'll turn it over to Tracy.
Yes. Thanks, Jolene. So I'm just going to go over some findings from the key informant interviews with respect to flavored tobacco. And just to provide you some context before I go on, key informants included 16 in total, and these were 7 tobacco enforcement officers, 5 managers, and 1 NGO rep, and 3 vape shop owners, but that will be more relevant when we talk about the Electronic Cigarette Act. And the interviews took place in October and November 2016. So, like what Jolene mentioned, about half of the key informants felt that compliance with the flavor ban was strong, noting only initial instances of non-compliance. Challenges were reportedly resolved within the first few months once enforcement activities began and enforcement units received more information and guidance from the ministry. So factors that were important for achieving strong compliance included stopping the supply of flavored tobacco at the manufacturer or wholesaler level, proactive retailer education, consistency in enforcement practice, provincial teamwork, which was facilitated by the Protection Enforcement Task Force, and ministry support. So that being said, key informants did note several implementation challenges with regard to the flavor ban. This included lack of knowledge, education, and resources to prepare enforcement staff for implementing the ban. And informants thus highlighted the importance of having education and resources to support enforcement well in advance, such as, for example, ministry tools and fact sheets. And this would help to alleviate concern about appearing ill-informed in front of retailers who sometimes had more updated information about the ban than the enforcement staff, for example, saying that one product had been approved, whereas the enforcement officer didn't know that as of yet and thought it was illegal. Some key informants suggested keeping enforcement staff better informed about the outcomes of Ministry, Manufacturer, and Health Canada meetings so they could stay up to date and understand why certain products are allowed and others are not. And I think this kind of cross-cuts every policy measure that we talk about today, but key informants described encountering capacity issues in 2015-2016, especially in light of legislative changes. And they noted that realistic resources beyond one-time funding to support enforcement units were suggested in light of increased workloads due to current and future legislative changes. And as Jolene noted, though, the main, implementation challenge that survey respondents and also key informants encountered was the modification of tobacco products by manufacturers to circumvent the ban. And the most common modification folks spoke about was relabeling packages so products fall under the flavored tobacco exemption. So, for example, I don't know what this product might have been before, but I've heard like honeyberry becoming wine and things like that. Other ways in which circumvention occurred included the use of colors to connote flavor and labeling products to advertise that flavored cigars meet the 6-gram weight requirement when it was unclear if it actually did. And there was also an unexpected issue with retailers that sell flavored shisha with tobacco in one region. In this region, enforcement staff encountered some resistance from the distributors who were not aware that the ban applied to flavored shisha with tobacco. So this resulted in some shisha brands rebranding their products. And I think one of the takeaway messages around this issue was that just staying on top of how the industry is modifying their products is a constant and resource-intensive process for enforcement staff. So key informants suggested ways to make circumvention more difficult for manufacturers. First, key informants said what they really needed was a compendium of products to help enforcement staff understand what products are legal and which are illegal, even if it just acted like a baseline document with which they could work. Some informants also spoke about having more concise and tightened legislative language, as well as more clarity about the intent of the legislation. For example, one key informant suggested focusing legislation on removing flavor from tobacco completely rather than what they considered it was, quote unquote, putting rules in place around the apparent appearance of flavor. And finally, as noted by the manager in the quote in this slide, some key informants suggested that the ministry play a greater enforcement role at the manufacturer level. This is the case because having enforcement officers continuously assess products to see if they meet regulatory requirements. For example, does the cigar actually meet the 6-gram weight requirement? Let's go weigh it. We don't know, blah, blah, blah. Was considered inefficient and might result in inconsistent enforcement practices. Also, some mentioned that there's not much more enforcement officers can do at the retailer level, especially if the packaging appears to be compliant and the retailers are simply selling what manufacturers are supplying them with.
Okay, so in this last section, we will present the evaluation results for the ban on e-cigarette sales to youth under the age of 19 years. In the first half of 2016, so that's January to June, 90% of tobacco vendors, e-cigarette retailers that were inspected, did not sell an e-cigarette to the test shopper. A number of factors contributed to the success of the youth access to e-cigarettes implementation. These included increased awareness among tobacco e-cigarette vendors, improved compliance among tobacco e-cigarette vendors over time, increased public awareness about youth access to e-cigarettes, and the opportunity to educate retailers. Tobacco enforcement officers and managers reported encountering some challenges when implementing the youth access to e-cigarettes provision of the ECA. These included test shopper exposure to secondhand vapor, lack of public education and awareness, lack of awareness among tobacco e-cigarette vendors such that vendors don't understand all the products that fall under the e-cigarette definition, lack of staffing to proactively enforce and to address complaints, failing to include e-juice as a component of the e-cigarette was noted as a legislative gap, and finally, lack of training for TEOs and test shoppers resulted in test shoppers not knowing what jargon to use when making purchase attempts, but also both TEOs and test shoppers were unprepared to identify and deal with the multitude of products and e-cigarette components.
Thanks, Jolene. So key informant interviews. So consistent with what Jolene just said, key informants generally describe good vendor compliance. Like with flavored tobacco, proactive education, including educational packages and in-person visits with ECA stakeholders, was important for developing relationships between vendors and enforcement staff, and as a result, achieving higher compliance. In addition to proactive education, having a similar minimum age policy in place before the ECA legislation also facilitated compliance. For example, as noted by some enforcement staff and by all the vape shop owners we spoke to, many vape shops already had a minimum age of purchase policy in place before January 1st, 2016. That being said, there was less than optimal compliance in 3 of the public health jurisdictions represented in the interview. And in 2 of these regions, compliant issues mostly involved convenience stores and pharmacies. Brings me to the next theme. So this is a pretty prominent theme across the interviews, which is basically differences in compliance by vendor type. So according to key informants, compliance in specialty shops or vape shops appeared to be stronger compared to convenience stores. Key informants described a relative lack of knowledge about e-cigarettes and regulatory legislation in convenience stores. Many reported that vendors were sometimes unaware that e-cigarettes were being sold in the store and questioned the amount of organizational training and education that vendors had received about the product and legislation. As noted by the manager in the quote on the screen, convenience stores sell many different products and often more profitable products, which might detract attention from e-cigarettes in the store. On the other hand, vape shop staff were considered knowledgeable about vaping products and legislation because their business is pretty much entirely focused on vaping. A vape shop owner noted that staff in specialty shops not only have the in-depth knowledge, but also the capacity to help customers use vaporizers to address their smoking, whereas this capacity is probably absent in convenience stores. And one vape shop owner felt that the youth access stipulation was necessary because it really aligned age of purchase policies across convenience stores and vape shops and other stores that sell e-cigarettes like gas stations. And this was another prominent theme that came out of the interviews. Just identifying stores that sold e-cigarettes and vaping products was really perceived as labor-intensive and an ongoing task. Some noted that having municipal licensing structures in place, for example, a tobacco licensing structure, facilitated identification of stores that sold e-cigarettes since they were already registered with the municipality. So enforcement staff often called or visited tobacco retailers on their vendor list to ask if they did or did not sell e-cigarettes, but this proved challenging because of the lack of product knowledge among convenience store clerks or the cyclical nature in which they sold cigarettes. So they're selling them, they're not selling them, and so forth. Identifying vape shops was equally as labor-intensive, and with one manager describing it as a boots-on-the-ground surveillance exercise. So having a specialty shop provision for vape shops, similar to that of a tobacconist, was proposed as a solution because tobacconists are required to register with the ministry. Vape shop owners were generally, when we asked about this, they were generally favorable to having a tobacconist-like designation. And as Jolene mentioned, key informants expressed a lot of concern about sending youth test shoppers and in some cases enforcement officers into the specialty stores or vape shops because of the unknown risk of secondhand vapor exposure. And a few key informants noted that for this reason they send the enforcement officer in to do inspections instead, do not test shop vape shops, or are waiting to do so until legislation that restricts vaping in public places is in place. And as Jolene mentioned, another reported challenge was just unfamiliarity of test shoppers with the large amount of vaping products and terminology, which might alert the vendor that the young person is a test shopper. Okay, so to close our presentation, I'm just going to briefly go over some findings from our exploratory youth interviews. We felt it was really important to speak with young people in the evaluation because the new UCA policy measures are largely framed in the context of protecting young people from the potential harms of vaping. So we conducted interviews with 11 young people about their experiences with e-cigarettes and with the minimum age of purchase policy. So just to give you some context behind who we actually spoke to, participants were recruited from a Young Parent Resource Center, a panel of young people who had completed another study on e-cigarettes, and a youth volunteer group. The majority of participants identified as female, as white, were students, and were from an urban community in central West Ontario. The average age was about 18. All had tried an e-cigarette in their lifetime except for one. Three had vaped in the past 30 days. 9 out of the 11 had tried cigarette smoking in their lifetime, and 6 out of the 11 were current smokers. So, experiences with purchasing vapes. About half of the participants were aware that you had to be 19 to buy e-cigarettes or vapes. 4 participants noted that it was now harder to buy e-cigarettes from retail environments compared to before January 1st, 2016. One young man noted that reduced accessibility combined with the availability of alternative substances in particular cigarettes, alcohol, and marijuana, were reasons why he no longer vaped regularly. Similarly, two young women noted that it had been harder to purchase since January. However, they didn't really consider this an issue because in their social networks, more people smoke cigarettes anyways. The remaining participants noted no changes, nor did they anticipate changes in their own or their friends' ability to purchase e-cigarettes. This was mostly because they felt there would always be some stores willing to sell to minors, and this was a very strong perception among the young women from the resource center. Participants also felt that vendors would be less likely to ask for ID if the customers looked older, had a vape already in hand when they were in the store, or had a child with them. And, like cigarettes, participants noted that there would be other means of accessing e-cigarettes besides your traditional in-person stores. Like online retail sources. So two participants who were university students noted that their friends had increasingly relied on online stores to purchase e-cigs. So one of these participants, in the first quote, explained that while her friends still obtain e-cigarettes from older friends and from vape shops that didn't ID, they preferred online stores because of they offered the most advanced products. She also noted that her friends mostly went to vape shops to buy e-juice. On the other hand, four young women from the resource center noted the opposite, that young people in their networks didn't purchase e-cigarettes from online stores because they didn't know these stores existed or because it's more convenient to just walk into a convenience store compared to ordering it online. So social sources, most interview participants felt that even if access to commercial sources was limited, it would still be possible to access e-cigarettes from an older friend or sibling, or to purchase a used or discounted device from another young person. In fact, when we talked about participants' first experiences with vapes, which I didn't go into here, it was most often in a social context with friends or a group of friends. And finally, if we kind of mix online and social sources together, we have social media as a way to access vapes. And for example, these two participants described how social media facilitated obtaining vapes just generally, and as this woman noted by scrolling through Snapchat. She was showing me her Snapchat during the interview, all the vapes that were coming up for sale. Okay, that includes our presentation. So it's a lot of information. It's kind of difficult to provide a full summary because of the breadth of the new measures covered. But generally, the findings shed light on successes, learnings, and opportunities for improvement with respect to the new measures that are being implemented in Ontario. And as Michael noted in that methods slide at the beginning, we'll be continuing to monitor and evaluate new measures over the next year and look forward to updating folks in the future. And lastly, we just wanted to thank those who are part of our new measures advisory group who has helped to guide this project over the past year. And that's it.
Okay. So we have some time for questions. You'll notice on the left-hand side of your screen there's a chat box there. Feel free to type your questions in there. In the meantime, we already have a few questions here. So the first one is, were there similar support percentages from smokers prior to smoking in restaurant bans? And can we expect this to change over time in a similar fashion?
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for your question. I think that we did see increasing levels of support for smoking ban after the implementation of the restaurant embargo. That is certainly something we'll see. I don't know exact numbers or how these ones compare for patio versus bars and restaurants. We should likely expect this to increase over time. We haven't seen that yet. I think partly we're still working on awareness and implementation. It may be a little bit different than the restaurant and bar band interior, where there's a more clear benefit for the band, for the smokers themselves, who I think also appreciated the indoor smoke-free places. Whereas the bar or the patio ban is a little bit more inconvenient, and I think other research has shown that those more complete bans on smoking in other jurisdictions have led to more changes in smoking behavior because of the ban. And partly that is because it is a bit more inconvenient. So we probably would expect this to be a lower level of support, but to increase over time.
So the next question is, what were the specific challenges associated with having overlapping SFOA and bylaws?
So to that, I would say it's mostly related to the setbacks. So a lot of municipal bylaws are 9 meters setback from a playground or sporting areas, whereas the province is 20 meters. And likely also some differences in definitions of what constitutes a playground versus at the different levels, province versus municipal.
The next question is, do you have any correlation between those that are sitting on municipal council or enforcing the bylaws being current tobacco users themselves? I've had a few situations where this has actually been a barrier to enforcement or compliance with the current laws and or moving forward in terms of getting of going above and beyond SFOA municipalities or hospital properties.
That's a very interesting point. We haven't come across it or don't have any data to support it, but I can understand that might be explain some resistance to get signage posted or pass other more restrictive bylaws.
If anybody on the line has had experience with this and you want to type it in the chat box, feel free. In the meantime, we'll go to the next question. Are there any examples of retailers that have stopped selling tobacco products or vapes? What reasons have they given for stopping to sell these products?
I know in the informant interviews, a theme that I didn't talk about since we had so much to discuss was convenience stores getting out of the business of selling e-cigarettes, mostly because they weren't selling in stores, but also TEOs telling me that the vendors have had bad experiences with the distributors and things like that. But, yeah.
Okay. And here is a question from Susan Himmel. Do you know if anyone has explored or approached social media owners, i.e. Snapchat or Instagram, to ban e-cigarettes, tobacco advertising to underage youth, since they have the demographic and geographic locations of their users? Tracy's shaking her head, saying no, they don't have, no one's approached them that we know of. Are there any other questions from the audience? Well, I had a question, actually, just to give people some time to think. You mentioned that TEOs are suggesting that they don't have enough training or they're not understanding what the products are. Have they suggested a way to sort of beef up their knowledge?
Teresa mentioned a compendium of products. I think a lot of it came out with a lot of initial confusion in the first few months of the ban being established.
No, that's right. Knowledge about e-cigarettes and all the different atomizer, different component parts that come with it, and also having that information in a timely manner was very important across all of the new measures, I think. But that was that, and then for flavored tobacco, what's legal, what's not legal, why isn't it legal, things like that.
We do have another. Did you have
music? Just to add on to that in terms of the enforcement and the law itself, I think it's probably a complicated, the way it's written is really hard to understand. I suspect was to thread the needle in terms of, delineating between legal and illegal products. And this regulations on flavored tobacco are themselves a response to earlier federal laws that had sort of essentially major loopholes for cigar and cigarillo products that were trying to be closed by this law. I think one of the sort of lessons going forward is that these type of loopholes, are just difficult to deal with, both from an effectiveness of the legislation themselves and from an increasing complexity of enforcement for the legislation.
There's actually a related comment here. As someone who's interested in hearing more about the industry adjustments being made in terms of avoiding the laws.
I think it's not so much as avoiding the laws as in dealing with them, I guess, or finding the letter of the law rather than the spirit. That has certainly changed over time. That we have noticed that there are different stickers that have been placed on packages, that the names of the brands and of the have changed over time, and I think that's been an ongoing, from our discussion with vendors, it seems like it's been a bit of an ongoing process in terms of figuring out what is an appropriate name or not. I think what we're interested in doing things like looking at these changes now that all these flavor products are being called wine or port or whiskey. What does wine smell like? And what does port smell like? And are these flavors? When we talk about the smell of wine, we often say, "Oh, it smells fruity." So what are we doing in the end by allowing these descriptors what's being covered under those labels? I'd say the manufacturers and retailers are trying to adapt to the laws as they understand them.
An enforcement question. Was there any difference in types of locations that were more likely to sell e-cigarettes to test shoppers, convenience stores, e-cig specialty shops, or pharmacies?
I forgot to mention, when I did the analysis for the e-cigarettes, so I did mention I only had a half year of data. So there were 1,000 premises across the province that were inspected out of approximately 6,000 that are listed in TIPS. So the 90% was good, or 95% was good. I did do the analysis by premise type, but I don't have it here with me, and I don't feel comfortable saying it just because the numbers aren't quite there yet. When we have full year data, so when we have all 2016, I'll come back and answer that question. Sorry.
Thanks, Jolene. Are there any other questions? Waiting for the chat box. Yes. Was the amount of interaction between the tobacco manufacturer and the ministry looked at? Did ministry consultations with industry increase due to the implementation measures?
Tracy's shaking her head. I don't think we captured that.
No, I don't think we captured that, or we would know whether or not it would increase them, and there are clearly negotiations that were going on, partly by manufacturers trying to understand what the limits of the law were, it's hard to know we don't know the baseline, and we don't know the current or the change, and we don't know the impact of that on policy, unfortunately.
I've come to the end of our questions here in the chat box, and if there aren't any others, I'm going to say thank you to everyone who joined the webinar, and thank you very much to Michael, Tracy, and Jolene. Following the webinar, you'll be sent an email, and there will be a link in that email to the evaluation survey. If you could take a few moments to complete that, that would be super helpful for us. It allows us to serve you better. The slide deck, as well as the audio and video recordings of the webinar, will be made available on the website after this webinar, probably in the coming days. And a link to the page will be included in the evaluation email. Okay. Oh, we have one more question. How have hospitals dealt with butt litter in neighboring areas?
That is a really good question. The only answer, well, we don't really have an answer to that one. It was just mentioned as a challenge because people are being pushed out off the property of hospitals, that butt litter was becoming a common complaint from the public. So, unfortunately, we don't have an answer to that question.
Okay. Again, thanks everyone, and have a great day.